I met Peter when I was in college. He was at least twice my age, a big, burly man, and we shared at least one thing in common. We had a habit of walking around the city during sub-zero temperatures with only jeans and a hoodie on. I've since smartened up a little bit. His sense of humor was a bit edgy, but when he told one of his particularly punchy jokes, he would begin to laugh so hard, it usually ended up with him bent over in a fit of coughing, sometimes a little tear forming in the corner of his eye. That was his joy. That was his joy. We were, by all societal measures, a pretty odd pair. A pretty odd pair to become friends. Me, a 20-year-old Anglophone college student from the West. Him, a 40-something-year-old Francophone who was learning to read and had just recently been released from prison. I met Peter as part of a program that surrounded former offenders, in the program's language, our core member, with a group of six people tasked to be supportive relationships, helping them navigate the life after incarceration. Mostly, we just met up at Tim Hortons and chatted. Around Christmas, we would gather in his small apartment for a little Christmas party. He had hoped his sister could come, but she couldn't. So it was just the seven of us, sitting around his tiny table, sharing in a meal and exchanging a few trinkets. Before I met Peter for the first time, I was handed a large folder. Inside were Peter's criminal records, which he had consented for all of his support team to have access to. I carried around that heavy folder for weeks in my backpack. Each day when I opened my bag to go to school, there it was, beckoning me, challenging me. But I struggled. Should I look? Do I want to read? What if what I read is so horrific that I couldn't bear to be around him anymore? Bear to be around this man who I was becoming friends with. The program that we were part of had two fundamental and interlocking values. The first was no more victims. And the second is no one is disposable. The harm caused by our core member was never, ever diminished. But the entire hypothesis of this program was with the right support, these guys wouldn't reoffend, sparing our community and our core member from additional pain. And yet they also affirmed at the same time that no matter the crime, no matter the harm, that no one is disposable, that no one should be thought of as beyond the point of redemption, that every moment exists the possibility to exchange the title of offender to former offender, and to exchange that forever. And that maybe, just maybe, this transformation would be hastened into being if these former offenders were surrounded by people who would help them navigate their life, who would help them navigate their court and parole conditions, help them attend their meetings and navigate the transit system, but most of all, would just go and buy them coffee and sit in Tim Hortons for an hour and just talk. Most of society, if they knew what Peter's crimes were, would never want to live in the same building as him, never want to even see him walking out of a prison. There is no understatement when I say that his crimes were horrific. And yet each time we met, I struggled to hold those two truths together. Peter, his past that contained such violence, and Peter, the friend that I was making. His past, which contained violence, and his joy and his laughter. The weight of the file in my bag was a constant reminder of that struggle. I never did read his file. But through my year-long relationship with Peter, I had stumbled into one of the most vivid and real expressions of my universalist faith. And so I gave back the file. Not because I didn't want, not because I wanted to downplay the impact of any of his actions, but because to be worthy of support, love, and friendship, he wasn't required to be perfect or have been perfect, or even his actions to have been anywhere close to what anyone would have judged as good. For him to be worthy of support and love, the only requirement was for him to be human. He didn't need to earn any worth. No crime could strip that from him. So in the end, it didn't matter the details to me. No more victims. No one is disposable. My time with Peter reminded me of a story about the famed Universalist preacher Hosea Ballou. Now, Hosea had gone inland to a town to preach, and he had made arrangements to stay with a woman who, as it turned out, was not of the same persuasion as Hosea. She believed that only a few people would be saved by God and brought to heaven. So after arriving to the house on Saturday night, Ballou found her in her kitchen, mop in hand. Looking up, the woman said to him, "Well, this is Mr. Ballou, I suppose." "Well, Mr. Ballou, they say that you hold that all men will be saved. Do you really believe that doctrine?" "Yes, madam, I really do believe it," he replied. "Why, sir, do you really believe that all men are going to be saved just as the creatures they are? Do you really believe they are going to be saved just as they are?" Now, one thing you know before I go to the rest of the story is that Hosea Ballou was renowned for his wit, but also his self-promotion. All right. So he responds, "What is that in your hand, my dear woman?" "Why," she replied, "it's my mop." "Your mop? Well, what are you going to do with that?" "Well, I'm going to mop the floor, the same thing I do every Saturday afternoon." "Well, sister, I understand you," Mr. Ballou said. "Now, are you going to mop the floor just as it is? Or are you going to require it to be made clean before you mop it up?" "You wish to know if I hold that all men will be saved just as they are?" "Well," she replied, "I'm going to mop it up to clean it." "True," said Mr. Ballou. "God does not require men to be pure in order for them to be saved. Love is the means by which we are purified and saved. They are exactly what salvation is designed for, not just the perfect." Ballou preached a gospel of deep and true love from which no one is beyond its embrace. That no matter who you are, what you have done, what you think about in your darkest moments of your life, that you still have dignity. That no category of people is beyond the pale. That no persons, no matter their crimes, are disposable. And while that doesn't mean that all actions are acceptable and without consequence, it does mean that even those who have transgressed the rules like Peter cannot be stripped, nor should they, of that transforming power of love. This is the most difficult gospel for us to live. This is the most demanding and exacting gospel of our lives, especially in times such as these, when our society is being rocked by the forces of hatred and division, who will tell us that it is those people to be blamed for the destruction of our country, our county, our neighborhood, our family, or for the loss of the election, who will offer us easy solutions, will just deport those people, or move to another neighborhood, or better yet, move them to another neighborhood because someone just needs to take out the trash. When white nationalists step out into the open and are now given a national pulpit to spread their vile lies, the reality is, if I am completely honest with you, I just want them gone. I don't want to redeem them. I want to label them as a them, and all of us as an us. I don't want to be reminded of the ways that the us permeates white supremacy too, albeit on a different level. I just want them gone. But our universalist faith, it demands no less of us. To not push anyone outside the circle of the embrace of love, to not strip anyone of their dignity, of holding the possibility for the power of real love to work its way through our collective hearts, and reminding us the dignity of each person, no matter their background, status, culture, sex, gender, orientation, or expression, that somehow we find a way, because throughout human history we know the stories of scapegoating and politically expedient compromises that have led us down the other path. Our universalist faith asks us to make the vow that this time we're all going together. Universalist minister Clarence Skinner put it like this: humanity must enlarge the borders of its consciousness to include the whole human race. We must think, feel, and act in universal terms, and thus see how petty and sinful are the partialisms of our lesser selves. We must welcome difference because life in a varied world is richer than life in a uniform one. Universalism, as Reverend Nancy MacDonald Ladd writes, is the unyielding belief that each and every person is endowed with an original blessing that calls them and claims them regardless of circumstance or worthiness, that you do not have to be good enough to deserve basic human rights, you do not have to earn safety. We are inherently enough that we don't need to prove it. An original blessing, coding humanity in a fundamental unity, propelling us into time, all souls bound together, whatever our purpose is, whatever our destiny may be, what we are told and what we know is that it is a collective one. An original blessing, outright rejected by many, for the story they would have us tell is that the only the worthy, only the good, only the people who look like us, act like us, speak like us, have the same abilities as us are the important ones, the ones who have a stake in this common destiny. They are the only ones that should be afforded rights or dignity or love or connection. But each and every time, we allow humanity to be divided into an us and them, a saved and a damned, the good and the bad, the right and the wrong. We split apart this original blessing. We remove the very basic dignity that is fundamental to being human from a person. We, in fact, expel them from the very status of being human, fracturing that original blessing not only from them but from ourselves. And we do it for totally understandable reasons. We are afraid. We want to understand. We want to feel like we have some power in the world that seems totally out of control. But as we sever ourselves from one another, be through it the clutches of racism or nationalism or throwing a group of people or just one of them into a category of inextricably other, we fracture ourselves into loneliness and isolation. It is in isolation that Hannah Arendt, the German-born Jewish political theorist, wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism, "It is in isolation that the common ground of terror takes root." She wrote this: "The preparations have succeeded when people have lost contact with their fellow man, as well as the reality around them. The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction and the distinction between true and false no longer exist. Terror can rule absolutely only over men who are isolated against each other. Therefore, one of the primary concerns of all tyrannical governments is to bring this isolation about. Isolation may be the beginning of terror. It is certainly its most fertile ground, but it is always its result. This isolation, as it were, is the hallmark. Its hallmark is impotence, insofar as power always comes. Power always comes from people acting together. Isolated people are powerless by definition. What perpetuates such tyrannical regimes, Arendt argues, is manipulation by isolation. Something sometimes most effectively accomplished by divisiveness of those us and them narratives. Exactly what our universalists would tell us we should not do. But Arendt doesn't simply leave this in the realm of political science. Isolation in the political realm sets the stage for what she describes as far more encompassing state of existence, loneliness. The most radical and desperate experience a human can ever face, that of feeling like one does not belong in the world at all, that one is disposable. The universalism we need for today is not the same universalism as the past. Our 18th century forebears preached against a world that said that your salvation, your ability to go to heaven, was contingent on the will of a vengeful God, or, on the other extreme, was contingent on your continued and steadfast and exhausting work to move towards moral purity. Those were your choices. God gets it all, or you have to be almost perfect. To these extremes, our universalists preached a gospel that all should be redeemed, no matter our strivings. The universalism for today does not speak to us about universal salvation in whatever lies in the mysterious embrace of death. Nor does universalism, as it's often mistaken, speak to us of universalizing of all religions into one path. Universalism for today does not call us to the politically expedient. If the cost would be further isolation, segregation, or polarization. The universalist toll that cries out to us now is the ring that demands our steadfast commitment to the kinship of all, to its central truth that whatever, wherever we may be going, we are going there together, that whatever our purpose is a collective purpose. Universalism for today is an answer to the longing in each of us for that elemental belonging that John O'Donohue writes about, that we yearn to belong, to know that we are not outsiders cut off from everything, because the most fundamental truth is that we are meant to be together. This truth is imprinted on our hearts and our very humanness. And that while we do vile things to each other in the quest to understand this yearning for belonging, this is why our universalist gospel tells us it is a sin that we miss the mark when we would strip humanity off another from removing them from the circle of dignity around any human being. That we deprive ourselves of the fundamental and elemental reality of belovedness as we deny the world the giftedness of any person. Hannah Arendt escaped Nazi Germany to become one of the 20th century's most influential thinkers, escaping a society that would have her killed because of her very birth. And the forces in this country are mounting. Immigrant families without food or housing will be threatened. Our universalist prayer is that in each of our hearts and in that of our body politic unfolds a great longing for that fundamental belongedness of all things, all people, all beings. Even for people like Peter, whose friendship taught me countless things about repentance, redemption, and the power of love beyond all measure. One day, Hosea Ballou was riding the preaching circuit in New Hampshire. And of course, he ran around with a Baptist preacher. They would go to the same town, preach in two different churches, ride on to the next. And along the way, they argued theology as they traveled. At one point, the Baptist looked over at Hosea and said, "Brother Ballou, if I were a universalist and feared not the fires of hell, I could hit you over the head, steal your horse and saddle, and ride away, and I'd still go to heaven." Hosea Ballou looked over at him, and I imagine just the crick of a smile formed. "If you were a universalist," he said, "the idea would never occur to you." May we strive to become those universalists, where that idea would never occur to us. Blessed be.